This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Bowinger Clear kicks. Bowinger Clear's won it for Australia. They're on top of the world.
Bling It On from Colt 31. And Bling It On. The comeback boys done it. Bring It On first.
It's still Rajasthan in front. And Rajasthan wins the Sandown Cup.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Yes, here we are, Simone, Matt and Dan. And I was just thinking as we heard that intro that race callers yell a lot, Simone, don't they? Why do they yell?
You just raised your voice too. Do you think he just yelled there?
Why do you yell so much, Dan?
They're excited.
Yells. It's a bit like a singer. There are ranges that they have. Oh. Some can yell and some don't have to yell to get their point across.
Well, you were the biggest yeller of the lot in that little build-up. Oh. No, you got left over the top by Matt Hill with Bowen de Clare, but great emotional calling. And Simone, you were at the Geelong Trots to see Dan in full flight last Saturday night for the Cup meeting, weren't you?
I was. It was a great time out there at Geelong Trots. Of course, it's close to home, so that was one of the big factors in me going. But I did spend the big race up in the caller's box, and it's quite amazing. It's when you work beside someone in a different way, you think, gee, you're very articulate, Dan. Just, I think your words, Matt, autopilot. It just, the way you just called it so fluently and calmly, and it was great. But I had a great night out there. Ran into people every five steps of the way that I know, and a few dog people or people that we've had dogs with or have had dogs with us as but they're harness people. So, yeah, great night out.
So you got VIP treatment. The race you came up to watch was the Cup.
Yeah.
But your husband and your daughter were out there, and how were their nights?
Yeah, great. I was given the VIP treatment. They were very good to me. Paul Prout from the Geelong Harness Racing Club, and everyone was just very friendly, and we sat up in the grandstand. They had the jousting there. The guys from Cryle Castle came with...
Yes, you do.
It used to happen on the dance floor at the nightclubs one stage.
A bit of impromptu jousting at the Trots, why not?
So it was a good night all round, I thought. Things, activities for the kids, but some good action on the track too. And Kate Gath, did she?
Yeah, she drove
about
three winners in a row, including the Cup winner, and Emma Stewart trained the trifecta. It was a busy finish in the Cup. There was nothing by a little bit more, and Emma trained 1, 2, 3.
Well, that was last week, and it was a terrific race, and again, the dominance of Emma Stewart continues. I'm looking forward to this week. We'll touch base shortly a little bit on a couple of great guests that you guys are bringing to the table in your respective codes of harness and greyhound, but my heart and the rest of my body is going to Warrnambool tomorrow for the Jericho Cup, and it's captured my imagination. My kids are coming down for a couple of days as well, and they like horse racing, but they love the Jericho Cup. And I think there's a interesting distinction there in the backstory of the Whaler horses and our history with horses through the war and the charge at Bathsheba. And I actually put something up on our website the other day, Dan, from a letter that was written by Guy Hayden, who was a lieutenant, and he rode a horse, a thoroughbred called Midnight, and she was immersed in the Whaler population in Palestine during World War One. You know, the Turks and so on, and he was injured in the charge of Bathsheba, and he wrote a letter to his loved ones from a hospital bed in Cairo, detailing what had happened a few days earlier at Bathsheba and how Midnight, who was the hero of her time, and to me, she's as great as Winx in a completely different way. She died in the battle. She took a bullet and died, and it lodged near his spine, and he survived because of the impact was reduced by Midnight taking the bullet. And so if anyone out there is interested in what I just said, there is a story of the letter. The letter is replicated on our website from a few days ago from Guy Hayden, and it's an amazing dramatic read, and that's, to me, that's all part of the vivid story that we're going to experience again down at Warrnambool tomorrow.
And this is just, is it right to say has rebirthed, or it's just birth? Because it seemed to be, if not dormant forever, and it's sprung out of nowhere, this particular race in the last couple of years. But it's not just sprung, it's burgeoned. It's quite big now, and I sense it's going to get bigger.
Well, it's going to get bigger and bigger. Well, Bill Gibbons is the sort of the philanthropist and war fat guy fascinated by war who created the idea of replicating the Jericho Cup. The Jericho Cup was run through the battlefields of Palestine as a distraction to the Turks. So it was basically, what are we going to do? We're a bit bored, but we're about to launch a major offensive against the Turks. Let's lull them into a false sense of security by putting on a horse race. You know, so they had all the Whalers and so on, and Midnight snuck in, and Bill the Bastard and so on, and they put the horse race on as a distraction. That was the famous horse, Bill the Bastard, who they wrote the book about. They put this horse race on and then launched a massive offensive against the Turks when they were least expecting it. And then Bill Gibbons decided to recreate it 100 years later, and that's what he did last year. And this is the second running of it. And Jess Liston is going to be our first guest, and she's the daughter of Peter Liston, who owns Three Bridges Farm up at, where is it? Up near Malden. And there was a dramatic story of Jess and others saving the last of the whalers from extinction, and they were lost out in the outback, and they found them and rehomed them and so on. And Jess is going to tell us that story. And one of her horses, Digby, is almost taking on the role of the new Sub-Zero, going around to schools and so on. So looking forward to that. Charlotte Littlefield's going to join us. She's got a runner in the Jericho tomorrow. Hello, My Friend, it's called. It won the consolation last year. And Dan, give us a snapshot. You've got a really special guest for us as well who's been through his own battles.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Sfinocio is, I say, an emerging younger trainer. He's not perhaps as young as you might think, but he'd sort of worked for a lot of people. He'd had a couple of horses of his own, but he's branched right out in the last couple of years. Had a serious illness where he was in hospital for at least 6 weeks, but he was out of action for a few months, and it was quite dicey where he was going. He had minimal fluid going around the brain, so severe headaches, neck pain, back pain, shoulder pain. It was actually a condition that was suffered by George Clooney. So I don't know if he's immersed out of that to be better looking bloke, but I tell you what, he really has gone to the next level as far as his training and driving is concerned. He's getting regular Metro winners, and he is going to set up a new stable. He's actually changing. Hart leads the way. So with his girlfriend, Elizabeth, they've got, I think it's Elizabeth's
property.
She's got
a bit of pedigree too.
Absolutely. Daughter of most famous vet, Alistair McLean. So Chris, new stables, after tonight's program at Melton, he's shifting all his horses down to around the Romsey area. So it's a new start for Chris, but he's right at the top of his game at the moment. He's a terrific guy, and we can have a good chat with him.
That'll be great. And Simone, you've got a greyhound trainer with a difference, Peter Gavin, coming on.
I have. So I thought after last night's glitz and glamour at the Melbourne Cup, and you see the best of the best go around, I'm sure people think, how do the dogs actually get to a Melbourne Cup and get onto a track? And so I've got Peter Gavin coming on, who is a greyhound breaker, much like a horse breaker, just getting them used to going into the boxes and jumping out and chasing the lure. But Peter, back after the live baiting, he thought there has to be a better way to show the public that we do not need to use animals, alive or dead, to get our greyhounds to chase. So he's also almost been revolutionary in his methods of getting greyhounds now to the track and breaking them in. And his waiting list is a mile long. We booked dogs in a couple of months ago, and they're not getting broken in until about March, April. So that goes to show how in demand he is. But we've all had to move with the times, and it has to start with the education of the greyhound. So just thought it was a nice segue from Melbourne Cup, seeing the best of the best, track records perhaps, and into
and a former postie. So our postman, where he used to be being chased by greyhounds, yes. And it may well be the reverse.
We'll ask him when he comes on, but do you know where he did his postie round?
Ballarat Way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So postman Peter, very curious. Not postman Pat.
You wouldn't want to dislike dogs. I mean, you might end up with a dislike for animals.
In spring.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what happened?
Plovers.
Spurwing plovers. I got attacked by them at Moonee Valley once doing a lap. Pardon me, I've got this shocking thing in my throat that's killing me at the moment. So just bravely soldiering on. So yeah, interested in the postie story. I've known a few posties over the years, and what they all started doing is they started getting that little motor attachment on their push bike just to cheat a bit too. So I want to ask Peter about...
Well, that was to get away from the greyhounds that were chasing them, I suppose.
Well, then they upgraded to Vespas as well. They used to hoon around on those little Vespas. So yeah, really looking forward to having a chat to Peter Gavin. Jess Liston is our first guest, though, and this is a rollicking adventure, this story from last April where she and others went up and saved the last of the whalers, and they're putting them to good use. And Jess is definitely going down to see the whaler commemoration as part of the Jericho Cup, and Jess has been kind enough to join us. How are you, Jess?
Good morning, Matt. I'm good, thank you.
You're well?
Very well.
Looking forward to the bull on tomorrow?
Oh, just busting for it. I went last year and it's amazing atmosphere, and to have so many people there connected and caring about the history of the horses and seeing it all play out again now, over 100 years later. It's brilliant.
Well, there's elements of it that are really close to your heart, particularly the history of the whalers as sort of the backbone to the battlefields in World War One, particularly. And I just want to start with the story. It was an amazing story when you first got contact, made contact with me and Michael Falgate and others about the lost last whalers up in the outback of the Northern Territory. Take us through the story of the saving or the relocating and the saving of the last of the true whalers.
Yeah, it was quite a big challenge for us. So I, of course, needed one of the best horse people I know of, and that was my mother, so I got her on board. And we needed, because the horses were on traditional landowners' properties up there, we needed permits and we needed to get a lot of people on board and to see our vision and our ideas of catching these horses.
So how did they come to be there and how did you come to be aware that they were there?
Yeah, so basically I've worked with an off-the-track thoroughbred and whalers in my own equine therapy business. And so because a lot of people were meeting them, then different people started sharing history and their connections to the war horses themselves. And I actually, there's a lady who lives quite as a recluse in Tasmania, and she's researched this breed and their history for over 40 years. So she actually shared her findings with me, and had all the research proving that there was a breed herd still running wild up in the Northern Territory, and that these hadn't had any other horses introduced to them.
Jess, when I watched the video clip that you've got as well as your story about it, I was taken away by in what good condition they were in such a harsh environment. But they also reminded me a little bit of the standard bred. They just didn't seem to be as hot as the thoroughbreds. Is that a true representation of the whaler breed?
Yeah, they're a really incredibly resilient breed. So now I've got my own whaler from up there back and he's already working in my therapy program. So from a wild stallion to being able to step up so soon as a therapy horse. But just recently I took him for a ride and we got to a puddle and he just drank the whole puddle. They're really resourceful horses, and that's different to my thoroughbred who I've had to teach to go through the puddle and, you know, slowly be gentle with him, teaching him how to go through water.
So take us through the mission to the Northern Territory.
So we went up for a week to meet people and to just get local people and Indigenous people up there to also see our vision. So we then met an amazing group of Indigenous stockmen who said that they would be happy to support us. So with getting everyone on board, and we got met lots of different traditional landowners, so then they could see the value and the purpose of our project. Once we had them on board, we had to then wait for the council to approve everything. So once the permits came through, we booked our flights the next day and got a hire car, and we got a mud map, and it was supposed to take us 4 hours, but with a mud map and no phone reception, it probably took us 7 hours to get to where they were. We had flat tyres and lost a wheel of the car. Like, it was quite challenging terrain out there.
And they were just out in like the scrub, just wandering about, were they?
Yeah, so it was pretty open land. There wasn't much food there. And they travel up to 50 k's to get food, and then there was an elderly gentleman who was giving them water at a bore, so they were coming into that bore to get water.
What happened, Jess, when you approached them for the first time, and this is probably one of the first times they've seen trucks and cars, and how did you coax them into getting them into yards to be able to load them? I've read stories about the Brumbies that the Wilson sisters have done remarkable work with, but imagine were you running by the seat of your pants at times?
Yeah, we basically took our time. So we had over a week, so we'd get up as soon as the sun rose and the horses were coming to the water with a bore. So we would take our time to walk behind them and slowly push them into cattle yards. And then by the end of the day, when we had the largest herd we could get in, then we'd draft out the ones that were the older mares, the horses that, I guess, basically were not going to be able to make the long 2,000-k journey back to Victoria.
And just to give our listeners a better idea of what we're talking about, the Whaler horse is an Australian breed, but it developed from horses that were brought to the colonies in the 19th century. And the name Whaler comes from the breeding origins in New South Wales. So the New South Wales part of it, the Whalers, is where the name comes from. And they're almost like bits of horses, as in part thoroughbred, Timor, Arab, Cape, etc.
Yeah, that's correct. So they basically made bred all different horses to make the most mentally and physically resilient and tough horse that could go into war and take people into guns blazing. And what makes them a breed is after breeding that, after five generations, then it's declared its own breed. So that's how they became essentially the Whalers. And the herd that we went up and brought back, we've actually had them DNA tested, sent off to America, and yes, luckily they are declared Whalers.
Wow. So you put them on the truck, brought them back, would have taken a few days. What level of education was, how did you educate them in order to rehome them? Because I know that they've all been, this is how adaptable they are, they've been rehomed, you know. So what was the process of getting them into a position where they could be rehomed?
So initially, we got their initial handling with Damien Ryder, an Aboriginal stockman in the Northern Territory. So the first stop was at their property for a couple of weeks to just settle into getting used to yards and, you know, fencing and things like that, and to take their time. So he spent a bit of time with them, getting them to feel safer around humans. And then Bruce, when we got them down to Victoria, we also sent the herd to Bruce Marsh to spend a bit more time learning how to lead and tie up and things like that. But basically, each person who's got them has needed to spend a lot of time building their trust with them, because when they haven't other horses that are unhandled, they've still grown up seeing humans and having quite a strong and positive relationship with them, even at a distance. Humans are the ones that feed them. So I spent hours just with my Whaler, just sitting with him in the paddock and getting him comfortable with who I am, so then that rapport and trust can be built.
So what sort of people have they been homed to?
We've got, all different homes. So Justine Hales has one who she's training up now to be a lead pony. They've gone, there's local people in the Macedon Rangers who've taken two for their kids, and they're going to be camp drafting ponies. And then we've even had someone up in Queensland who's bought a mare up there for their family, and it's since had a foal. And now we have, from the herd, we already have three foals at foot.
Well, Justine was involved in the Mongolian Derby, wasn't she? So a Whaler wouldn't have been her ride of choice in that, by any chance, Jess?
Would Nelly have been the right horse to do it?
Yeah.
I've had Mum late at night saying, yes, with that Mongolian Derby, I just keep thinking that we need one based in Northern Territory with the Whalers.
And if anyone could do it, your mum could do it. Hey, part of this story too is their use for therapy, and we always think about Sub-Zero as the irreplaceable ambassador for racing. And I know you got an ex thoroughbred called Jorge, who's named after Jorge Lorenzo, the famous motorbike rider who Mick Price nicknamed Caterpillar because he was so damn fast. And you got him, but you've also got Digby the Whaler, who's quickly becoming a star attraction, isn't he?
Yeah, I love taking them both into schools, and they both really resonate with people on different levels for different reasons. When Jorge comes in, it's really great for them to see that these thoroughbreds have such big hearts and they can connect with small children. He loves the pats. He loves being led around by little kids, and for them to see that you don't have to be great at anything, but by being yourself you can be loved just as you are, really helps children. As well as that, for them to meet Digby and know that only a few months ago he was completely wild, and that trust and respect you can have is something that once you have that, you can never take it away. So sometimes when I go into schools I get nervous, and I actually have Digby already scratching my shoulder just to support me with my nerves, and he's already the stable one. Different times he's been the one that Jorge's got a little bit of nervous, and we'll lead Digby through, and he takes that big deep sigh of relief that he's got this really stocky young Whaler there to support him.
I know myself, Jess, I've got horses and they're just so intuitive and just wonderful, wonderful animals. But given the success of this first, I guess you could call it a maiden voyage, have you got plans to bring some more whalers down from the Northern Territory in the future?
At the moment, we're trying to increase the demand of the whalers so that more people can see the versatility. So with visiting lots of schools with both, I guess, Jorge, my thoroughbred, and Digby, it's just helping people realise that they can give these horses a home and they can be family pets. And for different ways they can include them into their lives. So at the moment, that's the next kind of journey to really raise their awareness. So we do have more great homes to get them into.
Sounds like Jorge might get bumped eventually by Digby. Oh. Digby sounds like a much classier act than old Jorge the caterpillar. Hey, Jess, I'm really looking forward to seeing you down there tomorrow at the Bull, because I know that the whole story is special to you and it's special to so many of us, the backstory of the Jericho, and the whalers are very close to your heart. And well done with what you did with the lost tribe of the Northern Territory, and fingers crossed that there is more rehoming to be done with these wonderful whalers. Thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes.
Thank you very much for having me on your program, and yeah, it's been a pleasure.
What an amazing story. When I first became aware of it, I sort of couldn't get my head around it. All these amazing things of the lost tribe of horses, and then learning about how significant these horses have been through our history. So what a great job she's doing.
Oh, how determined. That would be something I would think of. I'd have this idea, I want to do that, but the logistics and, you know, the steps involved to actually execute it, I'd be thinking, oh, I'm just not cut out for this. It's too stressful. So for her to see that project from start to finish, I mean, that's an amazing achievement in itself. And we do hear about the whalers, I guess, around Anzac time and all of that. But we do need to remember that these horses, they gave their lives for us to enjoy today, didn't they? And they were part of that big light horse brigade. And I remember seeing that movie at high school as a teenager.
The Light Horseman.
The Light Horseman, yeah.
Andrew.
John Blake,
yeah.
Yeah, and I remember there was one scene where they had limited water, but, you know, one of the guys went and tipped his hat upside down and put the water in for the horse to drink. So.
And Dan, they are bitzers, aren't they, in that whaler origin? And Jess told me at another time that they're like a Labrador. You know how she told the story about how Digby was nuzzling her along, pushing her into school, and the other horse, the useless one, Jorge, was basically was getting all nervous. But they are an amazing, easily domesticated, friendly breed.
Well, yeah. It's a terrific story, and it was great to get the insight into why, but also the connection to the Jericho Cup and Australia's history. And we're going back to early colonisation of Australia when these horses were effectively introduced. But well, I say introduced, but they had bits of all types of equine Great. In them, which has made them far more resilient and created their own breed. But of course, usually bitzers live longer, they're a bit tougher, aren't they?
And
they're
street smart.
They're very resilient, yeah. Obviously. Mm. Oh, it's a wonderful story, and she's doing a great job.
Absolutely. Just before we go to Charlotte Littlefield, who's going to continue our Jericho theme, because she's got a runner who won the consolation last year, just on the hundreds of, I think there's about 180,000 whalers or something that went over and only one came back, Simone, but it wasn't all death in battlefields. There was they physically were unable to be brought back, a lot of them, weren't they? And they sort of became immersed into the Egyptian population and others. And I know you've read something about someone discovering them much later and the sort of the state that some of them were in, and looking at caring for the dying whalers of the Middle East.
Well, that's right. And it was all war horses, really. So there was a lady back in 1931 called Dorothy Brooke, and she was in Cairo, or went back there. And so it was getting at the tail end of the horses that had been in the war, but these poor horses were, she said, most of them were blind, they're all skeletons, you know, having a life of hard labour, leg problems.
They would have been close to 30 years old, a lot of them.
Yeah, and where you can understand where there's poverty and desperation, there's no compassion. And these horses were abused, and she had one that she couldn't even get him to eat bran mashes. She took him under her wing, I guess you could say. Many of the horses were euthanized on the spot because of the terrible condition. So then it started a welfare charity called The Brook, which exists today, and it's all about improving the welfare and life for working horses and donkeys in particularly those third world countries. So it's nearly 100 years, or, you know, 90 years ago, and to think that her legacy is continuing to grow now as well, because there's still so many horses around the world that just live, you know, terrible lives. So if we can improve it, but we just always have to think about back to our whalers as well.
Absolutely. And Charlotte Littlefield is a young lady who is well aware of the backstory of the Jericho Cup, and that's why I'm sure she's really excited, more than she would be for any normal race, by having Hello My Friend go around as a leading chance in tomorrow's race. And Charlotte joins us. G'day, Charlotte.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, it's a fascinating backstory to this horse race, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So she obviously qualified for the race last year by winning the Repercharge. She didn't gain a qualifying run in the actual main event last year, which was a shame, because I think she would have gone pretty close in that main event last year. But she was untested at that distance, and we didn't go in knowing how she would go last year. We just knew she had the ability to run a very long way just from her work at home. But this year, we sort of got a bit more knowledge of her, and she certainly comes in with a good story behind her, and she's just been a little war horse for us. So we're excited to see what she does tomorrow.
And one really good element about her prospects, Charlotte, is the fact that Hello My Dear's record at Warrnambool is outstanding.
Yeah, she's certainly got a very good record there, and her and Lee have also got a very good record together. So it's just really good to know that she's got a good record there, and she likes rain-affected tracks, and I think there's a bit of rain coming, so that's also a little bonus for us. We'd love to see it in this soft region. I think that would be really beneficial. She's also carrying the lightest weight in the race with a few others, so I think she's got a few things up her sleeve going into that race. She's also, we've kept her a little bit on the fresher side. We certainly haven't pushed her too hard leading into this race. She had a break after that 3,800 metre race at Wagga Wagga. And this was the approach we had last year, kept her a bit fresher going into that big race. And I think she just had a bit more sprint than the others who had been up a bit longer and done more. So we're hopeful that that will work this time as well.
Just speaking of last year, when I spoke to you during the week about this race, to you and your stable represents the Melbourne Cup, and you were really emotionally drawn to the playing of the last post and the appearance of the light horse and the backstory of the war connection to these horses and so on. It's a different vibe, I would imagine, at the Jericho Cup.
Oh, definitely. And it's just a good way to remember. You know, as I said to you before, you've got Remembrance Day, and I think this just brings a whole nother level of remembrance to the general public and the racing crowd. It sort of brings people together of another opportunity to make sure we commemorate those lives that were lost, and also that the strength of the war horses. You know, horses have done so much for us throughout history, and they continue to give us so much joy. And this horse in particular, she would have been the ultimate. She would have been Bill the Bastard number two, I reckon.
Oh, now there's a statement. Now there's a statement. Hey, are they hard to train? I mean, we don't train a lot of 4,600 metre flat horses. Is it a nuanced exercise to get a horse right for this race?
Well, coming from a European background and an eventing background, we've always trained our horses a bit more like stayers anyway, with hill work, with deep sand work, with just more repetitions, you know, doing some interval training with them as well. But she has thrown a few challenges up this time. She's become a bit of a tie-up horse on occasion, and she can't do the intervals like she did previously. She gets a little bit worked up doing that. So we've had to just come in with a slightly different approach. She spent a bit of time at the Water Walker doing sort of three times the amount normal horses would do there. That's a happy place. That's kept her really happy. She's had longer, slower gallops rather than short, sharp intervals. Largely she's you know, coping really well with the workload. She's always been a horse you can pile the work into at home. She'll do 2-3 times more than every other horse does here. And she's that type of horse that gets stronger and stronger in all her work. So you do your four laps in the deep soil here at Narnagoon, and she pulls your absolute arms out. So you get to the fourth lap and the thing can go another four or five if you wanted her to. So she's definitely an out-and-out stayer. She's European in stature. She's got a massive girth on her, big rib cage. She's only petite, but she's certainly got a massive set of lungs and a really big heart.
Well, this is all devastating news because my kids have got a share in Plymouth Road who's got no hope of beating this monster superstar of yours now. So, all right. We'll sort it out over pizza tonight at 6 o'clock, Charlotte, down at the Bull.
Yeah, let's not get too ahead of myself, though.
All right. Well, it sounds like
less confident.
It sounds like you're in with a chance, and I can tell. And having spoken to you the other day, you've got a really good handle on the bigger picture with this race and the origins and the significance of the stories and so on. So good on you for being part of it, and look forward to getting amongst it down there tomorrow.
It's a privilege. Thank you.
Good on you, Charlotte Littlefield. There, guys. Just before we go to a break, I think this can be massive. This Jericho Cup. And I know that Bill Gibbons, and I respect everything he wants to do with it because it's his baby. I know he doesn't want to change the date or anything like that, but I think this can become an absolute institution. I think if they had it over the summer holidays, you'd get 20,000 there with the holiday crowds. And I just think with all the bad news vibes about horse racing to do with certain things, gambling connotations and welfare, this is such a unique entry point for people that you just can't make up, and here it is. So I think it can be massive, the Jericho Cup. Have you guys got any thoughts on how big this thing can be?
Well, it's definitely emerging that way. I mean, the airtime that it gets, and rightly so. Look at the beautiful stories that we've come up with on our show this morning. I found it interesting, very interesting. There's quite a story to be told and to be celebrated, and I think it's fantastic the way it's emerged. And it's a completely different style of race, this long distance race that we are not used to having in Australia. But at the same time, there are other races emerging throughout the course of the season at locations throughout not just Victoria, but New South Wales, qualifying clauses for horses to be able to get in. There'll be a full field every year looking at it. I mean, the prize money is going to dictate that anyway. And we're creating a big race day in early December that is still on the improve. I think it's fantastic. The whole concept needs to be applauded, but ultimately it needs to be supported, and I think it is.
I think just Australians in general, we're just so aware of our heritage, aren't we? And you only have to look at Remembrance Day and Anzac Day and the commemoration and the events that happen at those times. And I think sometimes the animals are lost in that. And there was pigeons and there was dogs, but the horses is probably the one that we can relate to the most as a society that they went to war. So I think this is a wonderful idea. And I think to myself, why hasn't someone come up with this concept earlier? And Matt, having been down in Warrnambool many, many years over the Seaside Carnival, which is that period after Christmas, New Year, the crowds they'd get at the Greyhounds, families, kids camping down at the beach, and they'd come up to the dogs, were absolutely massive.
They need something to do other than getting fly bitten, you know, down the beach.
Oh, well, or rugging up in the middle of summer because you've got the wind and the rain. But I think you've got a really good point there. And I mean, I don't want to get into the politics of when the race should be run, but I just know from Greyhound crowds, if you were to have a race like this at a time, holiday time, it would be absolutely massive.
Yep, I reckon it could be bigger than the three-day carnival in time. Anyway, that's the Jericho, and as we're giving you a day and a bit's warning, so if you haven't thought about what you're going to do tomorrow and you didn't know much about the Jericho Cup, hopefully we've inspired you, and it's only a three-hour drive from town, so you've got no excuse not to be part of it.
And if you do have a bet, the one thing about having a bet is having a good run for your money. The slowest horse will take about 10 minutes to run the trip.
Exactly.
The fastest one about 9. I'm jesting a little bit there. But what an opportunity. If you're going to have a $10 bet in the race, it's going to entertain you for the best part of 5 minutes, isn't it?
Value for money. There you go. You're listening to Cracking the Codes. We'll be back after this.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the Codes.
Magical around the turn. Ike raced away. Magical opened up on Imperial Whiz. My Sky Pocket getting home. Maori Law trying to pick up. Then everybody knows, but Magical's clear. My Sky Pocket into second makes good ground, but Magical's too good. Beat My Sky Pocket and Big Jack Hammer.
Well, well, well. It flew
and Big Jack Hammer, of course, is running through the Inner Dominion in Auckland.
Sounds like you're impressed with Big Jack Hammer.
No, I don't think I was impressed, actually. I think the drive might have let it down a little bit. Anyhow, that's a different story. One drive that didn't let down is also the training prowess as well as the driving prowess of Chris Sfinocio, who joins us this morning on Cracking the Codes. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
You've really been in super form, getting regular Saturday winners at Melton, and things are on the up and up at the moment in lots of ways for you, but you're daring to make a change to everything working so well at the moment. After the program tonight at Melton, you're going to have a new postcode.
Yeah, that's it. On Monday, we'll pack up all the horses and move from Bendigo down to my partner Elizabeth's property at Romsey. So, yeah. Sort of, the horses are going good, so it's a bit of a worry, but no, there's a lot to...
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, of course, Elizabeth McLean is your partner. And I think your first Group 1 winner was Anywhere Hugo, which you trained for Elizabeth. So I imagine the heart grew fonder between the two of you after a Group 1 success, and it's led you to where you are today.
Yeah, might have impressed her a bit that night anyway.
Is she a vet like her father?
No, she actually worked for Lloyd Williams for a long time until about 6 months ago as his office manager. So she's been involved with the thoroughbreds for a long time, but, yeah, not a vet.
Alistair, of course, Alistair McLean is one of the most famous vets of all time, and, there's some great stories involved, particularly with Popular Arm, and I think even Better Loosen Up, Chris. So I'm sure you've heard plenty of those stories.
Yeah, like I've always known who Alistair was. He's been spoken about in racing. Like if, you know, any good horse had had a problem for a long time, Alistair was a man to see. And like, you know, used to travel to Hong Kong to do surgeries on their top horses over there and everything. So I'm looking forward to being down there with him. He's sort of retired now, Alistair, but he's still pretty involved with the horses. We've got a couple of young ones to be working together, so it'll be great.
He's a handy person to have around, isn't he? He might just have to come out of retirement a few times if you've got an issue with a horse.
Yeah, well, he is retired, but if one of his friends or anything rings, he's still always available to help when he has to, but he's sort of pretty happy just poking along with his own horses and taking it a bit easier these days.
It was either he was so famous or Popular Arm was so famous that the x-ray of the screws into the knee of Popular Arm went on the front page of the paper. That's how famous that scenario was. Hey, Chris, I was just always curious about emerging stables in a competitive environment with the dominance of, say, Emma Stewart and the other big stables. How difficult is it to get a slice of the pie in harness training circles these days?
Well, it's difficult, but you can sort of, some people probably might complain about it, but I just see it as, Emma and Clayton, they're the leading stables and they're the ones you've got to be trying to beat. So I'm just trying to worry about getting some good young ones and hopefully we've got some nice ones to be taking them on in the next few years.
And you've got particularly your strengths with the train, the trotters, Chris, because of, well, obviously Magic Cool, but Kai Valley Finn, who's a Group 1 Vic Bred winner for you, Anywhere Hugo, likewise. Norkey, who's been a revelation for you as well. They're all in the trotting ranks, and as yet, Emma and Clayton, they've got one or two trotters there, but they haven't come with a charge of the Light Brigade just yet in the trotting division.
They actually outbid me last year at the trotting sales, and I'm getting a bit worried, so I've got to have my trotters going pretty good and trying to keep beat them when they start racing their young ones so they just might stick at the paces.
Well, there you go. There's a warning for everyone out there. But the money in the trotting ranks is fantastic. Chris, you sort of emerged that there's... I'll go back to a particular stage in your life because I'd say you were somewhere between a small-time trainer driver and, of course, you worked for a number of stables and you were really being successful working with Matty Craven. But then you got very, very sick. I think it was the start of 2016 and you might want to just walk us through what happened there because there was a period of time I don't think even you knew what was happening on, but it was rather debilitating what was occurring in your life.
Yeah, well, that's right. I was working down with Matty Craven and we were having a good run and drive. Matty was giving me a great chance and all of a sudden I was actually at the MCG listening to Kevin Bartlett speak and I got very ill real quickly and stretched over a few days not knowing what was wrong and ended up in the St. Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne with neurosurgeons standing around me bed all the time and talking about me but not to me and not really knowing what they were, what was wrong with me. But luckily they worked it out. I had a spinal fluid leak and they did a few surgeries and I was about 6 weeks down there. And then once the final surgery was done, the next day I could just get up and walk again. And like it was, I was a few months recovering, but the surgeons down there were unbelievable and fixed me up luckily.
I think it's everyone's greatest fear is lying in hospital, not knowing what's on, but being surrounded by concerned-looking neurosurgeons. Did you wonder about how close to the end you might have been, how close to death you might have been?
It was more that if they didn't fix me, I wasn't going to be able to get up out of bed, really. So, but, yeah, it was a real worry when one of the head neurosurgeon would walk away and the other neurosurgeons would be arguing amongst themselves and they'd be trying to tell me that he didn't know what he was talking about.
Oh.
And then so that, just the fact that they were all in, had different opinions was a bit of a worry. But like one of the surgeons there was just unbelievable, Mr. Hahn. And I think like, you know, you get sick in Victoria or Australia, you're just very lucky because if it happened somewhere else, like, you know, I could still be just laying in bed and not having very good quality of life. But luckily I'm fit and well and, yeah, training horses.
That was referred to as cerebrospinal fluid leak or referred to as CSF. A couple of famous people that have had this problem include Chris Kerr, the basketball player coach, and, of course, George Clooney. And I reckon when George Clooney was mentioned, is that where Elizabeth came along?
Well, I often refer to say that George Clooney had it, but when he had it, ended up in one of the best hospitals in LA, and it took months for him to come good, so I got out of it pretty lightly. But it's good company anyway.
What's been the hardest part of the recovery, or what was the hardest part of the recovery for you, Chris?
I just had to rest after it was all over and I was home out of hospital. Like, I virtually just lay on the couch for about, it was just a couple of months. But then once I was right, I could just get back into it and get my fitness back and start doing the things that I like doing again and working horses. So, yeah, it was once I was up and walking, I was pretty happy. It was all good.
When you got the second chance, I mean, you hear it a lot with people who have had a near-death experience that they have a different philosophy and a different level of energy and maybe even more energy to, you know, if you ever had a dream that you're going to do your best to fulfill it because you know how it could end very quickly. Did you come out of it with a different level of energy and so on?
Oh, I think you come out of it with a bit different attitude. Like, I'm sort of pretty happy doing what I'm doing now, working horses, and, you know, when you're laying there doing nothing, you'd be happy to doing anything else other than being sick. So, yeah, I'm happy doing what I'm doing and it's all worked out good.
Well, you've gone to another level, haven't you? You've obviously been inspired to go out on your own with a team. Your dad must be such an integral part, Pete, there with helping you and your team. But as I said earlier, you're getting the regular winners. You're getting regular Melton winners. You've had multiple Group 1 winners now. You've got a good stable of horses. So you really, no reason to have even looked back since that moment, Chris.
I'm very lucky. Obviously, my dad, he's in his 70s and he's been just, since I've been back in Bendigo, he's doing all the work when I'm off at the trot. He's often there feeding up late nights and early mornings, but like, I've gradually got some really good owners behind me at the moment, like Duncan McPherson from Aldebaran Park and Jim Connolly, who owns the Kai Valley Horses, and just gradually getting better bred young ones. So now I've got to keep doing the job with the good young ones that people are buying me and sending me and that sort of thing.
Now, you've got Michelle Phillips has been working with you, having a fantastic run in the sulky as well. Your brother is a steward, Steve. You've got a cousin, Toby, who was the trial driver of the mobile at Bendigo for years, became the HRV judge and timekeeper. Everybody, it seems, around you has got some input into the harness racing industry.
Is having a brother as a steward like having someone on the inside?
It's not that good. Normally, it's just people come up to me and say, oh, your brother was did this or did that and got me in trouble for something, but that's about all I hear of my brother at the moment. But, yeah, we just see each other on holidays and that sort of thing now.
The three runners you got tonight, they're probably three of the stable stars and they're flying at the moment. You might be able to tip our punters into one of them being able to back up and win. You must be pretty happy going there with repeat after me, Norkey, who is absolutely flying a revelation, and Magical.
Yeah, Magical's obviously, you know, a couple of his runs lately have just been terrific, and Michelle's driving him. She possibly has to work forward on him at the start, but if she can get a bit of luck and get up there somewhere forward, he should go really good. And Repeat After Me was terrific last week for Michelle, but he's got a lot harder probably competition with Hurricane Harley and a couple of others in his race. And Norkey's drawn well, but she's stepping up in class like it's her first real crack at Metropolitan Racing, so we'll sort of find out how good she is.
And how many horses are you relocating to Romsey? From Bendigo to Romsey, how many are you taking there?
We'll have about 18 to move. We'll sort of move them over Sunday and Monday. And then I've got half a dozen young ones down there all ready to get worked. And so, yeah, we'll have about over 20 in work anyway come Tuesday morning.
Well, you're going to have a busy weekend. Let's hope that you go out with a bang from the Bendigo stable at Melton tonight. And we wish you and Elizabeth and all the team the very best going forward. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Good on you, Chris.
Yep, thanks very much.
Chris Finocchio there. He's a star trainer driver. He's just a wonderful human being. And to know what he's been through and where he's at now, I don't think that there would be anyone that would be dismissive of him having success. And a big moment in his life too, shifting in with his partner and their stable. But I'm sure that he'll go ahead in leaps and bounds.
I've even got more respect for George Clooney now that I know he's been through the wars as well. So.
Yeah. But an inspirational story in the sense he was very ill, didn't know where he was going to get to, and he's having tremendous success now. That's good, Chris Sfinocchio. You're listening to Cracking the Codes.
And by the way, on Saturday night at the Trots, I ran into Jodie Quinlan. She was on the third episode that we had of Cracking the Codes, and she's back driving. And she looks really well, but she did mention that the sulky can sometimes be a bit jarring, the particular seat that she uses. So she's had to tinker around with that. But great to see her back on track.
And with a winner, because she had her first winner back on Wednesday. Stay at Melton.
Beautiful.
Our next guest is Peter Gavin, who is a greyhound breaker, but we might just listen to this little bit of music first.
Simone's a greyhound trainer. He's not a postman.
Oh, well, he was a postman in a former life. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, guys. How are we this morning?
We're great, but great to have you on the show after all the glitz and glamour last night of the Melbourne Cup and all these professional athletes going around, but it's not always like that. They've got to start somewhere, don't they? And that's your job. You're a greyhound breaker, but can you just tell us how it all started for you, Peter?
Yeah, for sure, Simone. One thing I will sort of say, the word breaker, I'm not a big fan of. I think that I know for the horses we use that, and we were just talking about Jodie. Congratulations on her win on the other night. But I like to call myself an educator, and I think going forward, that's what the public like to see us called. It's a more in tune sort of word, I think, with exactly what I do, which is teaching of the dogs or educating them. We're not really breaking anything. We're just sort of keeping them happy and teaching them what they need to do. But, yeah, last night it was a great night at the Sandown track. They put on a great night. I really just educate the dogs. They come to me after they get reared for the industry, and we teach them to chase properly and concentrate on that lure and really want that lure. And we've got little mini tracks that we use at home. The industry used to call those bull rings, but I've tried to change that to it's not such a great word, I don't reckon, the bull ring. So I've tried to change it to it's a replica of a smaller racetrack, in a sense. It's just exactly the same thing. I call it a mini track. We've got a couple of those at home, and we start to teach the young dogs on that and progress them to the track, to the Geelong racetrack or the Ballarat racetrack here in Victoria. And we just teach them one-on-one, lots of love, lots of pats, lots of cuddles, and we get them chasing around so that we can move them to the trainer. So I don't train as such. I concentrate on just educating for the industry, and then we've got our professional trainers out there that go to the races like Sandown last night.
I assume most of them have a natural instinct to chase, but there would be a spectrum of within that of greyhounds that require further education to do it, and others that are just jump on the bunny instinctively.
Absolutely, we usually start out with rags or teddy bears or even such things as plastic bags as their reward to chase, and once that starts to move along the ground. But yeah, a certain percentage. I'd say that all greyhounds for thousands of years, the way that they've been bred, have an absolute natural chase to just want to, anything they see moving along the ground, even a car chasing along the road, they see it moving fast and they think, well, can I run that fast and can I catch it? So I'd say that, look, they're all bred with that natural instinct. Some of them, like us humans, have a natural instinct to concentrate on a task a little bit longer than others, and some require a little bit more schooling. Like when we go to school, we get kept back in certain grades, and they're a little bit the same, you know, just more attention, more love. We can, you know, really 90-95% of the stock or the young dogs that come to us, we can teach to chase a lure.
Pete, I could imagine in your postie days that the doggies might have been the inspiration. Would have, you might have had a few wanting to chase you on the bike.
That's certainly the case, mate. It certainly was the case. I was a postie for 10 years. I loved the job. It was a part of my life, and GRV came out and done some articles when I was on the postie bike. I left that about 12 months ago. I still keep in contact with the post. They're a great lot of people, and I've certainly seen a lot of dogs at the front yard. Some are friendly and some are not, so you can probably judge for yourself.
Just on the postie side of things, A, where was your postie round, and B, in order of which was your greatest nemesis, was it the dogs, the magpies in spring, or the spurwing plovers?
I can tell you this, that I'm certainly doing a lot easier job now than I was then. It was a great job, but yeah, you certainly had some animals out there that would certainly come down and bark us at the gate or try to attack us, and you had the magpies swooping. We had in Ballarat, where I was in my last post, I was doing around near the lake there, and they got ducks and other different sorts of wildlife flying around. So I certainly love my job a lot more than I did, but it was a good job, the old postie job.
And times have really changed, Peter, and in a very short space of time too. I mean, it was once acceptable, and it's how I saw dogs being broken in, and I don't want to hone in on it really, but it was post-live baiting that you decided that being a greyhound educator had to be a lot different. And of course, there had already been changes made with Greyhound Racing Victoria. But, you know, when I was helping break dogs in when they were pups, it was a gutted rabbit on the lure, and that was acceptable. We've come a long, long way now, because there's not to be any animal products associated with educating a greyhound at all, is there?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I suppose the industry was trapped in a little bit of a time zone. I sort of got involved with educating, about four years ago, when the industry got into a little bit of trouble with live baiting. I was just owning a couple of dogs and educating a couple of dogs of my own. But once I witnessed that on TV, I decided that the education of dogs needs to change. It needs to come up to the century we were in. The customer needed to actually get video footage of every single time you were dealing or educating a dog. So all my customers and the draft dogs that we've got going, the national draft, all those videos, every time I'm working my dog in the mini track or each time I'm handling that dog, I've got a GoPro on my head, I'm videotaping it and sending it to all the customers. But we have to understand that times have completely changed, and GRV, since that moment, changed a lot of their head office. A lot of money got spent on intelligence, and only just recently GRV have come out on the front foot and found another instance only a few weeks ago. But they're doing such a great job, and we've got the new code of practice that's coming in start of next year, so the public can be absolutely guaranteed with the new code of practice that the greyhound industry going forward Is the leader of all canine institutions in the world, pretty much. It will give us a standard that every greyhound owner has to have that is higher than any council canine institution that we use for rehoming or any of the support networks in association with GRV. So it's really good for the public, but to have all the participants on board now looking at going forward with the industry, it's great. But yeah, that's really where I started, was watching that on TV, decided that greyhound training or the education of greyhounds needed completely change. And I had a bit of a background with sheepdogs, so that came to the fore. I thought I had to teach 35 things to a sheepdog, where greyhound I only had to teach it to chase and grab hold of the fluffy lure.
A far more simpler beast to deal with. Pete, greyhound racing, in fact, all codes needs people like you with that sort of mindset. So well done with what you've been what you have been doing and what you will be doing in the future. And thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes this morning.
Thanks, guys.
Peter Gavin there, and even his softening of the language, breaking is a hard term, and so is a bull ring, and so is a dead track, and so on. So I think we need to sort of work on the language a bit, and that's exactly
I think so. You know, there's a word that I've never used in a race call in the 21st century. There's one word I've never used. It might surprise a few people. Starts with W and ends with P. It's four letters.
Whip.
Yeah, yeah. I've not used it since the late 1990s. So I know where he's coming from. There are certain, and I don't have a problem with it, with that instrument. I don't have a problem. I like the way where we've gone to where we've got with the restrictions, but I still haven't used that word. People associate it as a dirty word.
Yeah, no, exactly right. Well, I'll be taking one down to Warrnambool for the next 2 days because I've got the two kids with me and I always need it close by. Yeah, good on you guys. I'm really looking forward to Sunday. I know today's Saturday. I'm looking forward to the Jericho. Dan?
Melton tonight, 11 beautiful. Races, Stall Cup tomorrow, and Tuesday, second round of heats in Auckland of the Inter-Dominion. You enjoy Warrnambool.
Good on you. And Simone will reflect on last night's Melbourne Cup as well in the next week, and there's all sorts of great greyhound racing coming up. That's it for Cracking the Codes. We'll see you next week.